All right. Hi, my name is Richard. I'm an alcoholic.
Richard. My name is Kyle. I'm an alcoholic.
And we promised the group a few things when we started. When we started this journey together, we said, we're going to try to go through the book with you as if you guys never went through the book at all. All right? And we also made some promises that we were going to try to read the book, like, to see if it could withstand a modern read, to see if the big book held the test of time, to see if it was, as in Gadamer's words, an eminent text. And an eminent text is just something like a text that can be read throughout the ages and still have significance and still have meaning. The Bible is an example of an eminent text. The Bhagavad Gita is an example of an eminent text. So we read the big book so far, and some of the things it said seem to be pretty timeless. Their description of the alcoholic, their understanding of the phenomenon of craving, the this obsessive compulsive nature that we have, it seems to be right on the money. So far, this book could probably be read 100 years from now, and people could still derive meaning from it, and that's great. We also promised some controversy. We promised that we would try to give some opinions to get you thinking one way or another, you know, take a stand, with the express understanding that we weren't coming up with the definitive way to do the book. We were just talking about our impressions of it, our interpretation of it, and hoping that that could start a meaningful discussion where we could talk and have a dialogue, right? And we brought today, it's a very exciting part of the book. You can tell by the look on Kyle's face, he's very excited. that we have some very good news and some bad news, you know. The good news is if you're new to AA, right, willingness seems to be the key. But if you've been around in AA for a long time, we're going to put your feet to the fire a little bit on this. And we're going to say, you know, do we take it to the next step? Where are we with our program? Because you know what? If willingness starts it, the relationship develops. You hear the call, but do we respond? That's some of the questions we're going to try to address tonight and see if they make sense to our modern life. Now, last week when we left off, we read a little bit about we agnostics, and we read a lot of good reasons why we need it. You know, we need it because, hey, my ass is in the fire. That's it. It's either take this or live with the world of I'm just going to not drink no matter what. But we know, right, that at certain times an alcoholic will not be able to call into mind with sufficient force the pain, misery, and suffering of even a week or a month ago, and he will be without defense against that first drink. It just says at certain times. It doesn't say all the time. So that means that 99% of the times I may be able to find out and call into my mind that thing that happened, but there's going to be 1% of the time when suddenly happens, and suddenly happened to Jim, didn't it? And suddenly happened to Fred, and suddenly happened to Bill. We saw example after example of how self-knowledge and willpower in and of themselves were not sufficient to create bulletproof sobriety. And then when that 1% thing happened, when that one moment happened between whether it was you going to take a drink, that you weren't going to say, I'm going to call my sponsor. And you weren't going to say, I'm going to go to a meeting. And it was all going to come down to this relationship. And so so what we read last week was a lot of compelling reasons why we need to do this. Now we're going to get to another part of it, and it's going to talk a little bit about some of the rationale that they use to say why this is practical and can work. So, you know, the first part that we read last week was more about convincing you that you have a need for this, and now we're going to read the part that builds the logical argument about why this is not so far-fetched. And with that, we're going to start the read. And since I bloviated first, you can go ahead and start to read, right?
Let me start.
Do you want to start to read over there?
Sure.
We're both going to comment.
48, middle of the page. Thank you. The reader may still ask why he should believe in a power greater than himself. We think there are good reasons. Let us have a look at some of them. The practical individual of today is a stickler for facts and results. Nevertheless, the 20th century readily accepts theories of all kinds, provided they are firmly grounded in fact. We have numerous theories, for example, about electricity. Everyone believes them without a murmur of doubt. Why this ready acceptance? Simply because it is impossible to explain what we see, feel, direct, and use without a reasonable assumption as a starting point. So this is interesting. You know, we have numerous theories, for example, about electricity. That has changed over time. Early on, people thought electricity was great for your teeth. It was like going to make your hair regrow, right? But and they believed these wild, ridiculous things because science told them it had a reasonable starting point. Right. And right now, what we're trying to do is build the argument. We explained last week about, I think we kind of hammered home a little bit how we needed to destroy intellectual pride and how you needed to be willing, open-minded, and honest to really get this. And now we're starting off building the argument for why you really need this.
And to add to that, I would say that it's very hard to wrap your head around this whole notion of God, because we don't have that foundation for belief. There's no one that could say, you know, I saw God on the corner of 42nd Street and 8th Avenue yesterday. So now it requires a certain amount of faith and a certain amount of, like, examination. So even though we're ready to believe any harebrained scheme that comes along about what electricity can do, we're sort of reluctant to do this because we live in the modern era. When I say the term modernity, it means like the modern life, how we live in the modern day. And in our modern day and age, we believe everything is scientifically explainable. Everything is without a cause and effect, we don't believe it. And this is what makes God so difficult to consume, because we don't have any real proof of God's existence. But we know from what we've read that we're kind of in a bit of a tough spot, because without the spiritual component to our program, we're not going to be able to make anything like permanent adherence to sobriety. It's just not going to happen. So maybe desperation beats us into a state of reasonableness. But we're going to try to examine this notion of what scientific belief does prove and does not prove. And we're also going to examine the part of what our hearts tell us is true or not. Everybody nowadays believes that scores of assumptions for which there is no good evidence. Did we read this? No. It sounds like we did, though, right?
Go ahead.
And does not science demonstrate that visual proof is the weakest point? It is being constantly reviewed as mankind studies the material world, that the outward appearance is not always the reality to illustrate. Let me read one more paragraph. The prosaic steel girder is a mass of electrons whirling around each other at incredible speed. These tiny bodies are governed by precise law, and these laws hold true throughout the material world. Science tells us so. We have no reason to doubt it. When, however, the perfectly logical assumption that underneath the material world and life as we see it, there is an all-powerful guiding creative intelligence, right there our perverse streak comes to surface, and we laboriously set out to convince ourselves that it isn't so. We read wordy books and indulge in windy arguments, thinking we believe this universe needs no God to explain it. Were our contentions true, it would follow that life originates out of nothing, means nothing, and proceeds nowhere. Now, I could start talking about that, or you can. What do you want to do?
You can start off. I definitely have a couple things I'm going to hit on if you don't touch on them, but you can take it from here.
Okay. So the thing that really pops out on me is the question, why are we so desperate to not believe? What is about it? Why are we reading? Why are we read windy books, wordy books, and indulge in windy arguments? What's the big deal? What is so reluctant? Why are we so reticent to accept this notion of this power, this force under that underlines everything? And I think the answer is the minute you kind of say that that's true, that's the minute you become responsible for your actions. That's the minute you're now accountable. That's the minute you can't say, hey man, I just did this out of the blind. So now all of a sudden, every move that we make, I resisted the notion that there's some being that understood, that daily knows what's going on with me. I thought, my God, if that was true, I would just walk around in shame because of all the things I've done. You know, we talk about the spiritual awakening in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we talk about it in terms of like getting connected to that power. Many of you maybe have felt in your life the connection to something spiritual. Maybe it was looking in the eyes of a child, your dog, for instance. You could look at your dog and see God. But you can only see God for a moment. You see? So we aspire in life to be spiritual. But we don't want to be a spiritual because once we're spiritual, we're accountable. Once you hear the call, you have to respond. So of course we indulge in wordy books and windy arguments about why it's not so. Why it's not so? Because if it's not so, then I'm not accountable to anything or anyone. So of course it makes a logical sense that I would fight and resist this with all my might, because once I accept the fact that there's this higher power, then I have to surrender. I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of God so I understand Him, right? Now, what's that about? I like to run the show. I like to be in charge. Shit, I know what I'm doing. But now, it's questioning that ability of myself to decipher the universe. And I have to, and it calls a lot of stuff into question. So it makes sense to me that you would resist that. Why would you resist that? Because it means, what does it say in our recovery? It means the destruction of self-centeredness. It means that I have to stop thinking about myself and I have to start thinking about other beings. And I don't want to do that because then as an alcoholic, I'm selfish and self-centered. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, absolutely. That was beautiful, first and foremost, so thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome, God.
So this idea of talking about electricity, right, and electrons and all the laws that govern them, when you get right down to it, I'm sure there are people out there who can adequately explain electricity, but as far as I'm concerned, I flip the light switch and magic happens. You know, I can't explain it, but I believe that when I flick that light switch, the lights are going to come on. I believe that concretely, you know, and then all of a sudden there's a hurricane and it doesn't happen and it blows me away. But there's a great, the one thing that Rich didn't mention in his arguments about accountability is this idea of control. If there is no God and I'm all that there is, what we're really talking about is what I can control. And we literally spent the past 8 weeks talking about how I have no control over alcohol, over ultimately everything. But if there's no higher power, then I have control. And that's poison, right? This illusion that I have control over so many things that I ultimately don't. Because what we're trying to do here is destroy the ego, right? A fantastic acronym, easing God out. I need to accept that I don't have control over so many of these things, and if entropy is the only constant, then I'm fucked, you know? I loved that argument about accountability, that all of a sudden, if there is a God, then I have a lot of work to do. But the something that I think always bears mentioning when we talk about this paragraph is this idea of control, and that there has to be something greater than me, because I think a lot about, you know, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, but I do not control anything. Oh my God, sometimes I can't control what I think, you know, the intrusive thoughts, all that jazz, but there is a moment of surrender here that we need to reach. And we have to accept that after a certain point, I'm not the be-all, end-all in this world. And I can't control a lot of things. And I think you were going to take the next paragraph.
Yeah, and I like this paragraph because this, to me, is the challenge. I have 19 years of sobriety. So the spiritual, the component of our program might just end up being willingness as you begin. And establishment of a relationship as you begin. But what does it look like over a period of time? And over a period of time, it's over here, I would say, this sums it up beautifully. Instead of regarding ourselves as intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation, we agnostics and atheists choose to believe that our human intelligence was the last word, the alpha and the omega, the beginning and the end. Rather vain of us, wasn't it? Now, once again, it's like, the spearheads of the universe. This is like a real challenge. This is like throwing down the gauntlet to people who have been in the program for a long time. You know, are you an intelligent agent? Are you one of the spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation? Or maybe in my program, maybe I'm saying things like, well, you know what the real object of my program is? So I can have a good life, I can make a lot of money, I can have a house, I can have all those worldly things, and that's what God wants for me. God wants me to have all the bells and whistles. But what is the challenge? Assuming that in, let's say, these 18 years I have been meditating and I have been praying, what is God telling me at this point? What does that sound like? It certainly doesn't sound like it did when I first came in, because all I needed was willingness and to develop the relationship. But once you develop the relationship, you are the intelligent agent. You are the spearhead of God's ever-changing universe. And what do you do with that? How does that look? Does that look like what? And it's a tough one, because it's so easy to fall onto the laurels of recovery and say, well, I'm not drinking and that's all I have to do. I just don't have to drink. If I don't drink, I'm spiritually connected and everything's fine. But isn't that a way of just saying, you know what, we think that we stopped too soon, that the cessation of liquor was not enough. We had to continue. What does continue look like after 5 years, after 10 years? It's a bit of a challenge. It's easy to dismiss this. It's really easy to just sit back and say, you know what? God, what God wants for me to do is to satisfy all my senses, to live my life, to have a great life, blah, blah, blah. I don't need to really help anybody. It's not part of the game for me. But it just might be. It just might be. I've never heard anyone who said, you know, I prayed and meditated for 10 years and my best thought came out was, why don't you go kill somebody? You know? Or my best thought came out, why don't you go abuse your wife? Why don't you go abuse your children? Why don't you go kick a dog? This is not the kind of thing that's coming out of my meditation and prayer. My meditation and prayer is telling me, what the hell's the matter with you? Snap out of it. Start being nicer. Treat people more lovingly. Be kind. Especially to dogs. Said that for Carol. So that's a challenge. You know, we're going to find out more about that. Did you want to say something?
Yeah,
read the
absolutely.
Next thing.
This touches on a couple of really huge points. The first being that there is a world of difference between knowing and acting. It's real easy to puzzle out the right thing to do. Are you going to do it? But I'm aware that something we've tried to stress on this journey together is that we're taking you through the book as if you were newcomers. But I think it bears mentioning that there is no real greater danger for a recovered alcoholic than spiritual arrogance. And the second you really start telling yourself, oh my God, I'm on the front lines. I am the spearhead and God's ever-advancing creation, you're probably in trouble, right? The second I forget that I'm really just another bozo on this bus, I'm in serious trouble. The important thing is, do you really try? You know the difference between knowing and acting. Do you act? Do you try? Because that's what this is. This is a journey about continual improvement. And every day is a chance where I'm gifted the opportunity to do better. The second I think, I don't think I've ever had a thought of thinking, I'm so spiritual. But you ever thought, I did okay today, and there was no way I could have improved? That's ridiculous. That is utterly ridiculous. You can always do better. And just to let you know, the second you really think you're at that forefront, you might have a little bit more work to do than you might have thought.
And, you know, we talked about getting through this whole thing today. We may or may not, because there's so much to talk about and there's so much to unpack in this text. And I before we even move on, I want to come back to this as well. This notion of, Thomas Aquinas said, I know the right thing to do and I don't do it. And I know what the wrong thing to do is and I do that. You know, and that's just, from a very spiritual person in his life. We know in our heart of hearts what's the right thing to do. And we don't do that. And we know what's the wrong thing to do and we do that. You know, there's a Buddhist expression that I love. I spent a lot of time doing some comparative religious studies, and I fancy myself more of a Unitarian than anything. And it's a term in a Buddhist doctrine called bodhicitta. All right, bodhi just means to like wake up. Every morning you get up, you bodhi. All right, citta means mind. So what does it mean to have an awakened mind? So this is what our spiritual program is about, right? We talk about the spiritual awakening. We talk about having bodhicitta. And now everybody could say, maybe I've experienced bodhicitta. Maybe I've had a moment, a God moment, where I was really felt connected. I really understood everything that's going on. But instantly, it was drowned out by worldly clamors. Oh, this is a beautiful sunset, but I got to get home going. Oh, wow, what a beautiful flower. I got to get to work. You know, things like that happen. But we all have those moments. Now, if you say to me, Rich, do you have bodhicitta? Are you an awakened mind? I'd say, no way. Just like Kyle said, it's very hard. You ask my wife, she's here, do I have an awakened mind? No way. I'm constantly falling short of the goal. Right? So there's another term called aspirational bodhicitta. In the spiritual, this is for the old timers, right? We aspire to do these things. Do we always do them? No. We always fall short, yes. But are we aware that it is our intent to aspire to be awakened? That's why people, when I laugh a lot of times in the program where they say, I had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You didn't have a spiritual awakening. You heard the spiritual alarm clock. And it told you, wake up. Aspire to be more than you are. And it's reachable. But it's only reachable if you do the work. It's about relationships. When we talk about prayer and meditation, we're not just bullshitting. We mean that if you do that practice, you're going to establish a relationship with a power greater than yourself that's going to give you that 1% bulletproof aspect of your sobriety. That's going to help you when that suddenly happens and when that curious mental blank spot happens. And it's only about you and your relationship with this thing. Are we all awakened beings? No. But we all aspire to be awakened beings. This is why, for newcomers, this is a walk in the park. This is not even about believing. This is just about being willing to believe. For old-timers, it's about aspiring to be the person that God meant you to be. And you only get that answer from the prayer and the meditation. Right? That's how it comes to you. So, to me, this is a real daunting part of the book. And we don't care if we spend the next 5 weeks on this. We're going to have a good time with this, right, Kyle? All right. So now, you want to read the next paragraph? Because
please.
I'm getting tired of my throat over here.
We who have traveled this dubious path beg you to lay aside prejudice even against organized religion. We have learned that whatever the human frailties of various faiths may be, those faiths have given purpose and direction to millions. People of faith have a logical idea of what life is all about. Actually, we used to have no reasonable conception whatsoever. We used to amuse ourselves by cynically dissecting spiritual beliefs and practices when we might have observed that many spiritually minded persons of all races, colors, and creeds were demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness which we should have sought ourselves. Right? We're not saying that, you know, everyone, there are bad people at church. You know, some people might gossip, some people might not practice those principles in all of their affairs. That doesn't matter. Those faiths have given purpose and direction to millions. It's not about, oh, but, you know, the Crusades were a bad thing. You know, who cares? It's not about, I remember I was 15 and I got kicked out of Thanksgiving dinner because I mentioned indulgences to my grandfather, which was not a good thing. There was a Catholic who just left in the room, and thank you for that. ultimately, what's the goal here, right? I think it's really cool if your goal is to be a bajillionaire and have a fancy car. But for me, the goal is to create a life worth living. And you look at a lot of these religious people, and they demonstrate a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness, which I should have sought. That is a dream. That is a dream come true, to have that kind of life. And I'm going to take the next paragraph, and then you can chime in. Because
one second, just one thing, Colin. I just want to say, on that paragraph, right, do the people that go to church aspire to be better? Damn straight they do. That's why they go to church. Do they fall shy of the mark? Sure they do. They're human. But when people go to church on Sunday, they are aspiring to become better people. So who the hell are we to knock what they're doing there, saying, oh, they don't got it right, and this one's wrong? No, we respect what they do because they're aspiring to be better. And that's what we have to constantly struggle to do ourselves. So we all fall shy of the mark. Go ahead, you want to agree to that?
Yeah, I was going to say something, and then I remembered the next paragraph says it perfectly. Instead, we looked at the human defects of these people and sometimes used their shortcomings as a basis of wholesale condemnation. We talked of intolerance while we were intolerant ourselves. We missed the reality and the beauty of the forest because we were diverted by the ugliness of some of its trees. We never gave the spiritual side of life a fair hearing. I used to be, so I'm working on this. It is very much so a work in progress, but I would love to meet the person in this room who's non-judgmental 100% of the time.
That's me.
That's you, is it? Is it, truly? I was so judgmental and so intolerant, at the same time terrified of being judged. Now, looking back at my parents, you know, how dare you judge me for not believing in God when I'm so intolerant of them going to church, of them doing any number of the different kinds of service they do in the community. You know, we talked of intolerance while we were intolerant ourselves. We judged the entirety of these faiths by the messed up stuff that some of their members do. That is absolutely ridiculous, because on the whole, isn't it a beautiful thing that these people can come together and express love and faith in a higher power? That is amazing. I come here for that. I'm not particularly interested in any sect or denomination, but I don't hold it against people if you are. However you choose to worship is an entirely personal matter, which is something we're going to talk a lot about tonight. That we are all on our own individual journeys here. But do not turn aside from the wisdom and the peace that can be offered from these faiths just because one or two assholes attend. Because there are assholes in the rooms too. I happen to be one of them. Are you going to let me stop you from wanting this? I thought willingness was the key. Sorry, I love that paragraph.
That's okay. In our personal stories, you find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. Once again, it's a very broad kind of brush. It's not saying, hey, there's a specific way you have to believe. Whether you agree with a particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. So it's not about, you know, reaching consensus as to what this power is. It's about, you know, creating it for yourself. Experience has taught us that these matters about which, for our purpose, we need not be worried. They are questions for each individual to settle in himself. And we've been talking about this again and again. This notion of the spiritual journey is not something that is like the collective conscience. We all agree that this is the spiritual journey, that each individual has their own spiritual path, and they find that spiritual path. So I want to say this now, even though I was going to save it for later. I want to say this now. Right. What if there is no God? What if there is no God? Right? Does it matter? Right? There's a guy in a book, a Stoic guy named Lucretius, who wrote in the book called De Rerum Natura. He said, if there are gods, they will take care of us. And if there are none, it will simply end. Either way, it will be okay. Think about it. I don't act well because I'm looking for some heavenly reward. I don't try to change my personality because I'm expecting some grand prize when I die. I'm working on becoming a better person because I want my time here on earth to be filled with happiness. And I know that if I don't embrace a spiritual aspect to my life will be miserable. In the book, we find it says, we found that we are the author of our own suffering. That means that we are the author of our own joy. So now, you know, I don't, like I said, I'm a comparative religious person, but I don't really think that it's relevant one way or the other. It's not why I do what I do. I do what I do because I want heaven right here on earth. Christ said it. He said, the kingdom of God is within you. Right here, I can open up my heart and I can experience the Holy Spirit. But how long can I do that for? Anybody can be enlightened for about a second. But try to expand that to 2 seconds. And then 3 and 4 and 5 and try to go through your whole day like that. That is what I aspire my life to be. It does not matter. If there are gods, they will take care of us. And if there are not, it will simply end. Either way, you don't have to worry.
Could I say something just briefly on that?
Sure!
Sorry. That's really great. I think I agree entirely, and again, feel free to copper resentment and 10th step it later. In terms of, like, meaning of life, grand scope of things, whether or not God exists doesn't really matter. Make no mistake, belief, faith, the work I put into it, these things are a huge part of who I am and what I do. And it doesn't change what I believe, what I feel. But I think a lot of times people might get caught up in thinking that they've stumbled onto some sort of universal truth in their conception of God, or the particular way they express that faith. And it's not about, oh, I'm right, right? Because we talked earlier about spiritual arrogance and this idea that I'm right and you all need to get with my program is real dangerous. It's not about that. It's not about, I know for a fact God exists, I know what God looks like, and my way is the only way to express that faith. It's not about that. It doesn't even matter if God exists. I believe, and I work really hard at this relationship. But ultimate meaning of life, 42 type question, I don't really think it matters. It doesn't change who I am or what I do or how I live my life. And if somebody came out tomorrow and tried to prove that there was no God, I would still be here doing what I do.
When we started the We Agnostics, we asked everyone to think about what that conception of God was to you. No, nobody did that assignment, by the way. But I'm not resentful at all. But I asked you to do things like, imagine a visualization of God. What does God look like? Is God a beam of light? Does God look like to me when I first came in, God looked like Charlton Heston from the Ten Commandments? What does God look like to you? You know? And that's an important thing because, you know, we come to this chapter with a lot of preconceived notions about what God is and what we expect of God. And in order for this process to work for Bill, right, he had to kind of like suspend a little bit of his intellectual pride. He had to kind of say, well, maybe I don't know everything, and let me open myself up to the possibility that that there's a God of my own understanding. And this was the thing that paved the way. It's the thing that I think blocks most people off from this, is because it's a very hard concept to get around, because you bring a lot of baggage with you when you start talking about God. Baggage of, like, let's say, I used to go to religious instructions when I was in sixth grade, and they would come and they'd cart me off to Catholic school at 3 o'clock because I was Roman Catholic, and the nuns would give me the whole doctrine about what God was, and I was convinced that God wanted to have nothing to do with me because I was just a sinner and that was it. So then when I came to this discovery that there was a need for a spiritual component, I pulled a lot of baggage with me, right? So what did Bill have to do? Bill had to suspend some of his old beliefs. In effect, he had to fire his old God and open himself up to the possibility. Now, let me just, you know, for the record, I actually do believe that there is a God, but I do not believe it in the sense that you might think. I believe that there is a vibration to the universe that we can all get in touch with. And all it's a matter of doing is adjusting an antenna. It's like I'm a radio with a broken antenna. If I fix the antenna, I could get in tune with the beauty of my life, the gratitude for life itself. Each day, each moment, it's like a precious freaking gift. But I don't walk around all day thinking, oh my God, what a gift I have. But if you think about it, even for a minute, you'll realize how blessed you are. And if you realize how blessed you are, how could you do anything except try to be an intelligent agent of God's march forward? You are the spearhead. Dave said it again. These ideas were radical and revolutionary. And for people that have been in AA a long time, you have to ask yourself, you know, is my program radical? Is it revolutionary? What's God saying to me? These are really important questions. And we don't have the answers. We just have the beginning of the dialogue, the discussion that we have with ourselves, maybe we have with our loved one over coffee in the morning. But it is an incredible journey. It is worth taking. And in order to get to the point where we could do the steps, we're going to have to make this connection. Because remember, all we're here doing is trying to convince you that there's a need for this connection. And once this connection is established, once there's that antenna is straight and I am frequency is tuned in, then I have that ability that when that suddenly happens, I don't have to drink because I'm just in the moment and I'm extremely grateful. Every day, I mean, in 19 years, and this you can ask my wife, every day I wake up and I say, thank you God for making my life. I look at this woman and I say, I love you. Every day, because I want her to know. I want her to know that I am extremely grateful for the minutes life gives me. We don't have anything except now. This is it. This is where we make our stand. There is no other place. So that's where I feel about the God thing. But once again, we're just building the logical argument about why it's necessary. Remember, the first part we read last week was just about why it's needed, because we're on the balls of RS, and if we don't get this, we're not going to be able to have anything like bulletproof sobriety. This part is about, you know, the logical argument about why it's doable. So do you want to read a little more, Kyle?
Yeah, absolutely. On one proposition, however, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. This power has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. As a celebrated American statesman put it, let's look at the record. So despite all of our different journeys, our different conceptions, you get all of us into a room together, and if we've gone through the work, there's one thing we agree in. That's the result of these steps. That's the miracle. That's as a direct result, as the direct result of having done this work, I was put into power, into contact with a power greater than myself. And every other person in the room who's gone through the work can say that. Whatever that power is not my place to say. It's my place to say, it's my privilege to let you know that we're Alcoholics Anonymous and we guarantee that. Try it.
Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have had come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude towards that power and to do certain simple things. I wonder what those things are. There has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking in the face of collapse and despair. In the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. Earlier on, I talked a little bit about our modern lifestyle. Right. Early on, I talked about, you know, when he says these people are worldly indeed. When I think of a worldly person, I think of someone who is affluent, who has seen the world. I've been to Rome. I've been here. I've been there. I'm a worldly person. Right. So affluence alone is not the thing. It's not about he who has the most toys at the end wins. Although in modern society, you might think that it's all about he who has the most money at the end of life was the most successful. He who has the most stuff wins. But we know that, you know, beyond the fact of having enough money to feed yourself and to clothe yourself and to get by, more money does not equate to more happiness. It's just there's a negative correlation to more money versus more happiness. And in our modern society, we're so caught up in our material world that we forget, we dismiss the spiritual world. We think it's nonsensical, it's irrelevant. But I think, in a way, we throw out the baby with the bathwater here, because there's a lot to be said for that spiritual footing. There's a wonderful book, Gina and I always go through it, by Leo Tolstoy, called The Death of Ivan Ilyich. And it's about a guy who had material, all good things in life. And he had a good house, and he had money, and he had all these things. But then he was going to die early. And when the whole book, it's a short story. I really recommend reading it. The whole book is about the relationship of what it was to live in a modern life, to live the modern life. At the office, it was just a matter of reshuffling who was going to take Ivan Ilyich's job. And it was but the inconvenience of having to go to the funeral and pay the obligatory respects, to be inconvenienced by this thing. To his own family, his wailing and pain became a source of annoyance to them. They almost wish he would just die already. But it was very telltale. It was very like, because he had to reflect on his life. And he had to think of his life and what meaning was derived from his life. And none of the meaning that Ivan Ilyich derived from his life had anything to do with his wealth or accomplishments. They had to do with his connection to that spiritual nature. And because we live in this modern life, we don't have that connection. We kind of disown that connection in exchange for material things. We separate ourselves from each other. We use portable devices. We don't even talk anymore. So What I'm trying to say is that, for me, this whole notion of, you know, I am going to dismiss my spiritual life in an urge or a desire to gain material wealth, leads to a life of futility and desperation, and it doesn't make happiness. So now I'm walking around. I might have all the bells and the whistles. I might have all the toys in the world, but I'm spiritually bankrupt. That's how come in our program it says from Park Avenue to Park Bench, it's the same story. We're spiritually sick because we've kind of cut out God, almost like kind of like an amputation of the spirituality of nature and for our material life that we've sacrificed. So I'm thinking that there's a big argument, there's a good strong argument that says don't just dismiss the spiritual aspect of life. Give it a fair hearing. Try to be a little more open-minded. And you are going to be surprised that, as it says right here, that they take a certain attitude towards that power. That's the attitude I just described. To do certain simple things, that's the steps. There was a revolutionary change in the way of living and thinking. Life doesn't change. my response to life changes. How I react to situations changes. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of total failure of their human resources, and they're not talking about the human resources department where you work, Carol, they found that the new power and peace and happiness and sense of direction flowed into them. They didn't say, they found that new cash source, new revenue stream flowed in there. Oh man, I hit the lottery. No. They made that connection, and as a result of making that connection, they lived their whole life is on a different footing. I'm telling you, if you're new in this program, this is just about becoming willing to believe. If you're not new, this is about putting yourself on a spiritual footing that'll change your life in a radical way that you would never believe. And it has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with your zip code. Want to read some more, Carl?
I just want to briefly...
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
This idea of measuring success in life based on material possessions. So I'm broke, right? I work for $9 an hour, pouring hot water over coffee beans.
You'll be miserable, Carl.
No, that's the cool thing. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, and happiness and sense of direction flowed into them. The way you measure that life worth living is not in the question of do I love, but am I loved? Because what I feel doesn't really matter. But at home, am I tolerated or am I loved? Do I go out of my way to delight my parents and my brothers? Do I really try hard? And I'm not that broken, sick thing anymore that just poisons the atmosphere. I contribute. I am of service. And I don't think being loved by them hurts them anymore. That is a beautiful thing.
And that bears repeating. It's not my capacity to love that means anything. It is the fact of whether I am loved. Do people love me? You know what I mean? Who gives a crap what I love and what I don't love? But if I can't generate the feeling of love for the people I love, they can't love me, then I'm in a spiritually bad place. I really am. So that to me is more of a measure of who we are. In the end of that paragraph, it says, when many hundreds of people are able to say that the conscious presence of God is today the most powerful fact in their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. Now, we talked about the building of the argument, right? First, what's building of the argument? We need this. Now building up the rational reason why. And it makes a lot of sense. Worldly people, hundreds of worldly people have had this experience. Why am I so busy building up arguments about why I shouldn't do this? Building up, reading books about why God doesn't exist? Because I don't want to answer the call. Man, when you answer the call, you get the challenge. And the challenge tells you things you don't want to hear. It tells you there are seven deadly sins. And if you look and examine in your life, you probably have to work on one of them at least this year. You probably have to look at some aspect of yourself. And that the absolute giving up of alcohol is just not enough. This is a challenge for people who have been in the program for a while. But if you're new and you're just starting, the good news. Hey, sit back, relax. Try not to be a judge of things and see if you can find the presence of God around you. And the answer is, according to these people, they have.
We're about out of time.
You know what's that? We're running out of time. We might have to save the rest of this for next week. Too bad. I wanted to get to that story. This is amazing. Okay, look at it. The world has made more material progress in the last century than all the millennia which went before it. Almost everyone knows that the reason. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today. Yet, in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. In the realm of the material, men's minds were fretted by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. Some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought the round world preposterous. Others came to nearly putting Galileo to death for his heresies. I'm going to read this one more paragraph. We'll save the rest for next week, okay? We asked ourselves this. Are not some of us just as biased and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit as were the ancients the realm of the material? Even in our present century, American newspapers were afraid to print the account of the Wright brothers' first successful flight at Kitty Hawk. Had not all efforts at flight failed? Did not Professor Langley's flying machine go to the bottom of the Potomac? Thank you, Professor Langley. Was it not true that the best mathematical minds had proved that man could never fly? Had not people said God had reserved this privilege to the birds? Only 30 years later, the conquest of the air was almost an old story. The airplane travel was in full swing. So just as we embrace scientific change and new innovations, that maybe we should really think about looking at the spiritual aspect of our lives and not be so quick to dismiss it, not be so easy to bring in all our old prejudices about what we thought about it. Maybe it's about as simple as just what Bill did, melting the icy mountain of intellectual pride. That's what the term he used that allowed him to take that next step. So taking that next step for someone who's new, we told you we treat you like newcomers, right? Just means being a matter of being willing, being a witness. Being here for a long time, it's a different thing. We promised you some controversy. We like to deliver on our promises. Okay. So do you want to close it out and then we'll open up for questions, Scott?
I would love to. Thank you. Are not some of us just as biased and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit as the ancients were about the realm of the material? What it comes down to is something you hear a lot about in the rooms called the gift of desperation. There is no one correct way to go through this process. I've met people who say that if you're not done with your fourth step by your first week in the program, then you're wasting time. I think that if that works for some people, that works for some people. Again, we have said this so many times, and please, if you get nothing else out of our talk, understand that there is no one correct way to do this. That being said, how desperate are you for the newcomers? How willing are you? Are you tired of it hurting? Then at what point do you set aside your arrogance and try? No one is expecting perfection. I don't care if you're a recovering alcoholic, recovered alcoholic, you've got 30 years. I don't care. You're not perfect. I regret to inform you. Are you willing to try anything? This is what it took for me. I had to go through this work. I had to be willing. I had to be ready to die at 6 months sober before I was willing to do this. And I can't give it to you, that gift of desperation. I can't. I wish I could, because that would make my job a lot easier. But I can't. And I wish it was easier. I wish you could just come in and, yeah, sort of think I should stop drinking and do the work. But I haven't met someone who's gone through that. Everyone I know that's done this needed it and wanted it more than life. And trust me, we spent 8 weeks getting you to identify with the idea of being an alcoholic. If you can identify with that, and you are not desperate to live, then you will get there.
Carl, I hate to disagree with you, but Carol and Kathy will agree. Regina's perfect. Regina's perfect.
Yeah.
I had to make sure I got that in for tonight, guys.
Gina is a vision, of course. We all know this.
Okay, with that, we'll open it up for questions or comments or feedback or whatever.
Or observations.
And
criticism.
You're in charge, right, of choosing?